Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, July 24th, 2017. This daily news and comment podcast is distributed free every day. And it's available on YouTube whenever I remember to click the three things that I need to do to put it on YouTube. Well, in the first concrete sign that the Trump-Russia scandal was ginned up to prevent Donald Trump from softening the U.S. posture toward Russia, the White House is signaling that the comb-over president is planning to sign the new sanctions bill that passed the House last week and had passed the Senate previously. And I find this fascinating because the Congress has acted based on secret information. And maybe they've got that evidence that's a slam dunk that, you know, Russia did have this long-running scheme to manipulate our election last year and choose Trump over Clinton. But this is a purely political action, at least as far as any public evidence goes. And I'm deeply troubled that we are going to ratchet up tensions with Russia based on these evidence-free, leak-based narratives. And the most recent leak says that Jeff Sessions had substantive conversations with the Russian ambassador that he failed to report. And I hate Jeff Sessions. I mean, there are very few politicians I feel that way about. But he is a low-life guy who I would love to see bounced from Washington, D.C. But to spring another leak on him and just put him in much more of an awkward position doesn't really achieve very much. And it, you know, just causes all kinds of problems for Trump. Not that I don't wish problems for Trump. But we are in this cycle where the leaks surface and it just continues to press this narrative that has no public evidence. And today we saw the testimony in private by Crown Prince Jared. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But these sanctions are going to, I think, produce a reaction from Putin. He took the last round of sanctions that Obama imposed and took them in stride, maybe on a cue from Mike Flynn or Trump or somebody in that mix. But Trump is cornered. He is handcuffed because if he vetoes these sanctions, his veto will be overridden and he will simply harden the narrative that he is in bed with Russia. And by signing them, he basically is forced to do something he didn't want to do. Now, most of his spooks joined the Obama spooks at the Aspen Security Forum last week. Mike Pompeo, the CIA director, and three other national security officials said they're absolutely convinced the Russians were behind the effort to influence the election. Dan Coats, director of national intelligence, former lame senator from Indiana, said there is no dissent. The Russians caught us just a little bit asleep in terms of capabilities. And he referenced France and Germany and said the goal is clear. They are trying to undermine Western democracy. And Trump's not buying it. He just hits his Twitter feed. And he is so lacking in self-discipline. Sunday, tweet. As the phony Russian witch hunt continues, two groups are laughing at this excuse for a lost election taking hold. Democrats and Russians. It's very sad that Republicans, even some that were carried over the line on my back, do very little to protect their president. Now, this is where it gets so ridiculous. Because he does have a point that this whole narrative is unproven and it puts him on the defensive, and I'm sure he's very angry about it, and some of that's justified. But here's a guy who has zero loyalty for anyone else. Just ask, say, Sean Spicer or any one of the five other people who quietly left the White House or the Trump legal team last week. There is no loyalty from Trump to others. He simply expects it to be delivered to him because, after all, you know, he's Donald Trump. So what are these sanctions? They bar American entities from doing business with any company in which a Russian individual company under previous sanctions owns more than a 33% stake. It's very hard for me to evaluate just who that hits and how hard. The New York Times speculates this could make Western banks far more wary of lending money to Russian companies in general, as the exact ownership of many of these is often unclear. And there is the provision calling for Trump to ban American investments of more than $10 million in Russian privatization efforts. That could put a damper on an already stalled drive by Russia to raise money by selling off state assets. Now, this Times article closes this way. This much is clear. The rapprochement that Mr. Trump talked about on the campaign trail is now further away than it was a year ago this month, when Trump first called on Russia, jokingly, he said, to hack into Mrs. Clinton's email account and publish whatever it found. Now, I see this as a win for the Democrats. They've shifted the blame from a bad candidate who ran a bad primary and stole it from Bernie Sanders. A candidate whose negatives were so hardened that she had no opportunity to persuade voters on the fence to come her way instead of Trump's. And blaming Russia is very easy because everybody believes that Russia's evil. But there's a new book out, and I'm scheduled to interview its author tomorrow. Dan Kovalik, I hope I pronounced his name correctly, has just published The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. And he is a guy who's really steeped in the history of the last 50 years and does a good job of showing the long arc, of America's tense relations with Russia, often stoked by false intelligence pumped in by the CIA. I'm looking forward to that conversation. So Jared Kushner engineered this arrangement where he went to Congress. He testified in private. I believe he didn't even have to swear an oath. I'll have to check on that, but I haven't seen any indication that his testimony is under oath. And this is a guy whose voice I don't think I've ever heard. We have all these pictures of the silent Jared Kushner walking around the White House, you know, with a flak jacket on in Iraq. But we never hear him utter a word. And I believe he gave a statement outside the White House earlier today. Maybe the news will actually carry a recording of what he sounds like. At any rate, with the assistance of a very skilled criminal lawyer, Abby Lowell, Jared Kushner dropped off an 11-page statement, and in that he just washes away all of the circumstantial evidence that has been used against him. He said, "The records and documents I'm providing will show that I had perhaps four contacts with Russian representatives during the campaign and transition. I did not collude nor know of anyone else in the campaign who colluded with any foreign government. I had no improper contacts. I have not relied on Russian funds to finance my business activities in the private sector. And I've tried to be fully transparent filling out my forms, but gosh," he blames an underling for sending them in prematurely. He talks about all the jobs that the Donald heaped on him during the campaign: finance, scheduling, communication, speechwriting, polling, data, digital teams, point of contact for foreign government officials. All these were tasks that I had never performed on a campaign previously. So that's his excuse: youth and inexperience, if any conflicts arise from the denials that he's made in his testimony today. "My father-in-law asked me to be a point of contact with these foreign countries. This is after the election. These were not contacts that I initiated, but I had incoming contacts with people from approximately 15 countries. Then he talks about his first meeting with Ambassador Kislyak of Russia, That was at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington in April 2016 at Trump's big foreign policy speech. He said that they met, exchanged pleasantries. It lasted less than a minute. And then after the election, when they received a congratulatory email allegedly from Vladimir Putin, they wanted to confirm that it was actually from Putin. And Kushner says he had to email a subordinate saying, "What is the name of the Russian ambassador?" Now, if that email can be produced, that's a big benefit for Jared Kushner, because unlike, Jeff Sessions or Mike Flynn, he may actually have evidence that corroborates his position. Then to the June 9th meeting at Trump Tower with the team from Russia. Well, Jared says he never read the whole email that said that they were going to bring dirt on the Clinton campaign, and he dropped in on the meeting. And when they were talking about, he said, "When I got there, the person who has since been identified as a Russian attorney was talking about the issue of a ban on U.S. adoptions of Russian children. I had no idea why that topic was being raised and quickly determined my time was not well spent at this meeting. I actually emailed an assistant after I'd been there for 10 or so minutes and said, 'Can you please call me on my cell? Need excuse to get out of meeting.'" Then he denies that he set up a back channel to communicate with the Russians. He said this is also innocent. In a December meeting with Kislyak, the ambassador wanted the Trump team to get information from Russian generals on the war in Syria. And they said, well, you know, these generals can't come to the United States. And so they agreed that they would like to get this information. They talked about, well, could we come to the Russian embassy and talk to them on a secure channel there? And the Russians said no. And so they agreed that nothing would happen until after the inauguration. Now, all of this seems fairly persuasive on the face of it. But again, this is a carefully written memo by a criminal attorney intended to put the best possible light on the activities of Mr. Kushner. But as Benjamin Wittes tweeted today, he found a very interesting phrase in the Kushner statement. And this relates to the Russians. "The fact that I was asking about ways to start a dialogue after Election Day should, of course, be viewed as strong evidence that I was not aware of one that existed before Election Day." Now, maybe Abby Lowell should have worked that line over a little bit better. But you can make a reasonable inference here that there was dialogue before Election Day. Kushner just wasn't in the loop. And over at The Guardian, Ed Pilkington, a New York-based reporter, says that Kushner may have dug himself deeper into a hole by leaning so heavily on personal ignorance as the core of his defense. By doing so, he raised a slew of new questions about how the U.S. president could have entrusted someone with such little foreign policy ballast with a powerful international portfolio. I love the way the British use English. Pilkington says later in his piece, Kushner claims in his statement that his 13 December meeting with the top Russian banker Sergei Gorkov had nothing to do with his business interests, despite the fact that as a New York real estate tycoon, his business activities were intricately interwoven with Russian money. "At no time," said Kushner, "was there any discussion about my company's business transactions, real estate projects, loans, banking arrangements, or private business of any kind." That directly contradicts Gorkov's own account of the meeting, which was convened, he said, to discuss new business opportunities with the Kushner companies. And I want to make clear, there is a separate Russian oligarch who, according to today's Guardian, was tightly connected to Jared Kushner, and his name is Lev Leviev. He is described as a billionaire real estate tycoon and diamond mogul, known as the King of Diamonds. He was a business partner of the Russian-owned company Prevazon Holdings at the center of a multimillion-dollar lawsuit launched in New York for allegedly attempting to use Manhattan real estate deals to launder money stolen from the Russian treasury. Now, where this gets interesting is that one of the attorneys representing Leviev and his company Prevazon is Natalia Veselnitskaya. She is the attorney at the center of the Trump Tower meeting last June. So, again, this is circumstantial. It's conflicting. I can't prove that Kushner dissembled or fudged or even lied. But some of the information appears to be quite at odds with the general notion that he tried to convey. And while they are serving selflessly the American people in the Trump White House, Jared and Ivanka continue to take in millions of dollars from the companies they say that they're no longer involved with. Now, on Ivanka's side, she has agreed to take a mere $1.5 million a year fixed payments plus her share of the profits from the Washington Trump Hotel. And just in the first 6 months of this year, she has received $2.4 million from her stake in the Trump International Hotel in Washington. So, you know, she's not going to be scrounging for change when she's at Starbucks or trying to borrow money from other people to pay for lunch. And the couple continues to benefit from an active empire combined between the two of them that's worth at least $750 million. From the start of 2016 to May 31st, she or her trust earned at least $6 million from the sales of her clothes, shoes, and other accessories. Kushner said he divested his some assets owned by his family's real estate firm, but since March, companies in which he remains invested have closed several real estate deals across the country, including the sale of properties in Toledo for $5 to $25 million and a purchase in Brooklyn, also worth as much as $25 million to him. So, these people just do what they want. They operate above the law, above the rules. These things don't apply to them because, hey, they're special. Their name is Trump. And the tweeting idiot can't stop himself. He continues to hammer Hillary Clinton. And this one is bizarre. You would think instead of tweeting out to millions of people, if Trump wanted Jeff Sessions to go after crooked Hillary, why wouldn't he just call Jeff and say, hey, Beauregard, this is what I want you to do? Now, Trump's all over the place. He said after the election that he wouldn't prosecute Hillary. And since then, he's, like I say, just offered conflicting statements. And, of course, this is an effort to divert attention from him. He also attacked Adam Schiff, the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee. Quote, sleazy Adam Schiff, the totally biased congressman looking into Russia, spends all of his time on television pushing the Dem loss excuse. I don't see the point of all this Twitter activity, but I don't see the point of a lot of things, can't you tell? Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Find people like Benny Alto in Oregon, Terry Paris in Berkeley, and we're just going to call him the Z-Man because a new annual subscriber asked to keep his identity private. Thank you. I do appreciate that. And I want to say farewell to a subscriber who was here from day one. Her name's Rita, and she emailed me a nice note recently. She said, Peter, I need to take a break. This stuff is making me crazy. She said, I like what you do, but I just told you, I'm telling you, I can't take no more. And Rita, come back whenever you're ready. I do understand that these are trying times and that they can fry the minds of otherwise great people. If you'd like to become a subscriber and take Rita's place, I'd love it. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click menu, pull it down, click become a subscriber. Takes you to the sign-up page. The bonus books are displayed there for people who take out a new annual subscription. And don't forget the PBC app for iPhone and iPad users, just $2.99 in the Apple App Store. And all of our podcasts are available on the PBC app. You may recall a couple of weeks ago I spoke to Bill Binney on our Friday podcast and video feed on Facebook. Bill Binney was the technical director at the NSA. He helped design a lot of the systems that are still in place today. And he's a member of VIPS, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And they've been writing open letters to presidents since Bush was in office. They wrote their first one to Trump. Let me read the executive summary. They made it easy for somebody with a limited attention span. Forensic studies of, quote, Russian hacking, end quote, into Democratic National Committee computers last year revealed that on July 5, 2016, data was leaked, not hacked, by a person with physical access to DNC computers, then doctored to incriminate Russia. After examining metadata from the Guccifer 2.0 July 5th intrusion into the DNC server, independent cyber investigators have concluded that an insider copied DNC data onto an external storage device and that telltale signs implicating Russia were then inserted. Independent analyst Skip Folden, a retired IBM program manager for information technology in the U.S. who examined the recent forensic findings, is co-author of this memo. He has drafted a more detailed technical report titled Cyber Forensic Investigation of Russian Hack and sent it to the offices of the Special Counsel and the Attorney General, and Bill Binney, formerly of the NSA, has attested to the professionalism of these forensic filings. Now, what I find interesting and is new from what I reported previously, because we did tell you about this 3 weeks, maybe a month ago, is the timeline. Because the inside leak to WikiLeaks that was announced by Julian Assange on June 12th most likely took place before June 12th. But the hack that has the leak that has drawn the most attention and has been improperly labeled a hack occurred separately on July 5th. And the details of that are better known because of the metadata on the Guccifer 2.0 email release. And what this shows is that somebody who was in the Eastern time zone was able to access this data and in less than 90 seconds transfer a large amount of information. I think I can find the number for you here. In the early evening Eastern Daylight Time, someone working in the Eastern time zone with a computer directly connected to the DNC server or DNC local area network copied 1,976 megabytes of data in 87 seconds onto an external storage device. That speed is many times faster than what is physically possible with a remote hack. Moreover, the forensics performed on the metadata revealed there was a subsequent synthetic insertion, a cut-and-paste job using a Russian template with the clear aim of attributing the data to a Russian hack. So, I find this fascinating. And it undermines the fundamental premise, the foundation of the whole Trump-Russia scandal, that it was Russia that hacked the DNC servers and gave that information to WikiLeaks. We have the timeline showing that WikiLeaks announced they had Hillary emails before the alleged intrusion on July the 5th. And we also know that the release of Vault 7, also cited in the memo here, Vault 7 came out earlier this year. It's CIA documents that show the hacking tools that are able to try to misdirect people and show that somebody else did it. And one of the items in Vault 7 is called Marble Framework, a program that the New York Times failed to report on, but the Washington Post did. And this Marble Framework was designed for flexible and easy-to-use obfuscation. The Marble source code includes a deobfuscator to reverse the CIA text obfuscation. So this shows more clearly than I've seen before, and it buttresses an argument that I've been making for a long time, that there are many ways to obscure the origin of a hack or other intrusion. And our hackers at the NSA and the CIA and military intelligence have gotten pretty good at it. And so these claims of Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear and the assessment by the CIA and all this stuff, I remain very skeptical of. I want to thank listener Jerry Freshia, who lives in beautiful northern Italy, who sent me a link to the Raw Story report that indicates that a new Pentagon study concludes that the U.S.-backed framework of international order that began after World War II is fraying and may even be collapsing. And this report was co-authored by Alternet and Nafees Ahmed, who is a respected independent journalist in Britain who I've interviewed once or twice before. A solution proposed to protect U.S. power in this new post-primacy environment? More surveillance, more propaganda, and more military expansionism. The document concludes that the world has entered a fundamentally new phase of transformation in which U.S. power is in decline, international order is unraveling, and the authority of governments everywhere is crumbling. The U.S. now inhabits a dangerous, unpredictable post-primacy world whose defining feature is resistance to authority. This report, based on a year-long intensive research process across the Department of Defense and U.S. Army, calls for the U.S. government to invest in more surveillance, better propaganda through strategic manipulation of public opinion, and a wider and more flexible U.S. military. Now, the article that I'm holding here is 7 or 8 pages. There's a lot of interesting information here. And as many people have observed, the U.S. empire is at risk. And we keep extending ourselves in ways that put it even more at risk. And since we can't even talk about promoting peace, about withdrawing from military actions that we have initiated or participated in, we have a solution to the problem as more of the same. More profiteering by the military-industrial surveillance complex, and more authoritarian approaches to situations around the world where we really have no business. I encourage you to follow the link and read the report at Raw Story. This one surprised me over the weekend. After promising to load up Guantanamo with bad dudes, Trump has reversed course in the very first terrorism suspect being brought to the United States to face trial. Wasn't sent to Guantanamo. He was sent to Philadelphia. Excuse me, I couldn't resist. The suspect, a dual Algerian-Irish citizen, is named Ali Sharaf Damash. He is accused of helping plot to kill a Swedish cartoonist who depicted the Prophet Muhammad in cartoons. He was arrested in Ireland back in 2010, released by a judge who refused an American extradition request. Then he was arrested again in 2015 in Spain, and that is where we extradited him from. And apparently the Spanish negotiated to keep him out of Gitmo. Now, I just mentioned that Pentagon report. Here's another inconvenient report that surfaced from the Trump State Department. Now, Rex Tillerson hasn't filled most of the second-level posts at Foggy Bottom. There are many vacancies there, and there are a lot of people adrift who don't know what their future is like and who are just kind of hanging on, waiting to see the promised or threatened reorganization of the State Department under Rexon Tillerson. But I got this report from the Free Beacon, which is a Jewish-American publication, and I learned about it Friday when I listened to Mark Levin's conservative radio show. The State Department is facing harsh criticism for claiming in an official report that Israel is to blame for terrorism attacks committed by Palestinians and accusing the Jewish state of being largely responsible for an impasse in peace negotiations. Well, by golly, that's actually true. But of course, we cannot stomach this because Israel dictates American policy right down to these kinds of reports. The State Department, in its latest annual report on global terrorism, blames Israeli security policies for stalling the peace process and claims that Palestinians rarely incite terror attacks. The State Department characterizes Palestinian calls for terrorism and violence against Israel as rare, stating explicit calls for violence against Israelis, direct exhortations against Jews, and categorical denials by the Palestinian Authority of the possibility of peace with Israel are rare. And the leadership generally doesn't tolerate it. Now, I think that the State Department has actually reported things that are accurate there. But it'll be twisted, bent, and rewritten under duress in short order. Friday is when violence broke out in Jerusalem. And I wasn't there, so I can't tell you the sequence of events. But Muslims are outraged that following one incident near the holy sites, that Israel unilaterally installed metal detectors and security fences to process people who were heading into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So according to initial reports, the first conflict was a Palestinian who entered a home in the Halamish settlement on Friday night. He fatally stabbed three civilians, two men and a woman, and then he was shot and killed at the scene. Then three Palestinian protesters were fatally shot in separate clashes in and around Jerusalem. And the conflict continued on and off over the weekend. A little more detail here from Vice News reporting that Israel brought escalations to a boil by closing the mosque for Friday prayers a week ago and installing metal detectors. That decision came after three Palestinian militants attacked a group of Israeli police officers guarding the mosque complex, killing two of them. All three of the attackers were killed. So a human rights attorney, Zaha Hassan, is quoted, "The restrictions do little to enhance the security of either Palestinians or Israeli police, but are a cynical ploy by Netanyahu to extend Israeli sovereignty in a place that has been under Islamic control for centuries." Now, Netanyahu is described as holding firm, vowing that the metal detectors will remain, despite Israeli army officials' requests that he remove them. And even a hardline cabinet member, Public Security Minister Gilad Erdan, an outspoken measure of these supporter of these security measures, yesterday said that the metal detectors might be removed, provided an alternative has been found. So it's not clear just how firm the Netanyahu government is on maintaining these measures. Also, in a deal that divides the Palestinians but may provide some relief for those trapped in Gaza, a bilateral deal between Egypt and Hamas is announced. This is tentative, but the plan is for a $100 million new power plant, which would reduce the power blackouts that are routine in Gaza, and an opening of the gates to Egypt. That would be in the southern end of Gaza. And this, of course, would divide the Palestinians. Nobody wears a white hat here. Mahmoud Abbas, the leader of the Palestinian Authority, had colluded with Israel to reduce the amount of electricity fed to Gaza in order to put pressure on Hamas and to try to squeeze them out. So it's ugly the way the deals are being made, and innocent people are left really in the midst of it all. Good news from Warsaw. I'm really surprised because after massive protests and the passage of a law that would have given Poland's new conservative president control over the judiciary, including the forced resignation of all Supreme Court justices so that the leader Andrzej Duda could pack the courts. Well, Duda has vetoed it. "I feel that the reform in this shape will not increase the sense of security and justice," whatever that means, but this is encouraging. He has sent the bill back to the legislature, and we'll see what happens there. New York Times demanding an apology from Fox News because Fox and Friends falsely reported that the New York Times had insisted on publishing a story in 2015 that had hindered the U.S. military's attempt to kill the Islamic State leader al-Baghdadi. Now, the Pentagon says that they didn't object to the report that the New York Times published, and that despite the Fox News report that Baghdadi's whereabouts had been leaked by a prominent national newspaper and that prevented them from killing him, well, this appears to be completely concocted. And General Mattis over the Pentagon notes that he believes that al-Baghdadi is still alive, despite the, it appears, dozens of times he's been reported killed. And finally today, KPFA is a beleaguered public community radio station. They call themselves Free Speech Radio. It's owned by the Pacifica Foundation, a powerful signal based across the bay from me in Berkeley. And I've been hosting programs to help find a solution to their political and economic woes here in the Bay Area. But I'm deeply disappointed that Free Speech Radio has withdrawn an invitation to Richard Dawkins to appear at an event that the radio station was planning to put on in August. And they withdrew their invitation and canceled the event because of alleged abusive speech against Islam. Now, Richard Dawkins is a respected atheist, and he has criticized Christians and Christianists, Islam and Islamists. Some of his language is a little strong. But I don't believe that it's hate speech. And I don't think that you can call yourselves Free Speech Radio and then pick and choose. They're claiming that, well, his speech is abusive against a group that's already under attack. And Dawkins, defending himself, said, "I have criticized the appalling misogyny and homophobia of Islam. I have criticized the murdering of apostates for no crime other than their disbelief. Far from attacking Muslims, I understand, as perhaps you do not, that Muslims themselves are the prime victims of the oppressive cruelties of Islamism, especially Muslim women. I am known as a frequent critic of Christianity and have never been deplatformed for that. Why do you give Islam a free pass? Why is it fine to criticize Christianity, but not Islam?" And again, I don't need to agree or disagree with specific points of view of Richard Dawkins. I defend his First Amendment right to speak his mind. Thanks for joining me for my News and Comment podcast. I remain your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.